What this does is, in effect, in a sense, fly in the face of this whole question of sacred space. Because once you say that, then it sounds like what Bill said, that everything's holy, it's all holy space. What, you know, what can you do? So what I wanted to do is to sort out where this idea went before the Hasidim came and essentially radicalized it this way. Because the earlier position is really very, very different. When you talk about holy space in Judaism, there's a very clear hierarchy that has been established for millennia that says that outside Israel is on a lower spiritual level than inside Israel. Inside Israel is on a lower spiritual level than Jerusalem. Jerusalem is on a lower spiritual level than the Temple Mount. And the Temple Mount is on a lower level than the Holy of Holies, which was the inner sanctum of the temple. Right? And this hierarchy is well established. It's very clear. There are a gazillion laws and issues built around it. The only questions that are of any interest, and I don't want to talk about it because it'll take too long, is the question of where the boundaries fall. In other words, there is a serious issue as to which cities in the area that we would today call Israel or its neighbors that were or were not within the boundaries of what was considered to be the Holy Land. So, for example, for purposes of tithing, the rabbis drew real or imaginary borders that do or don't include all the territories that exist today. And so, you know, the truth is, if you look at the history of the map, it constantly was changing over the centuries. But there are many different kinds of borders or maps. The lines get drawn here for one purpose and somewhere else for some other purpose. This is part of rabbinic thought and history. But that is, when we speak about holy space, that's what we're talking about. In effect, no matter what I do in Barcelona, I'm not going to have holy space. Holy space is in Israel. Right? I can turn the cup over as many times as you want, but I can't make holy space here. What I can do, however, is to establish sort of like a temporary place in which one gets a feeling of holiness. And you get this with synagogues, you get it with other places. I mean, I had never visited Auschwitz, but I imagine that's the kind of experience people have there. It's been created, if you want to study it, under our noses in New York City as a result of the Trade Center being destroyed. So now you have holy ground for Americans right there in the middle of Manhattan. And watching that develop has been an interesting phenomenon from the point of view of modern religion or secular religion. But these kinds of spaces are not sacred spaces in the same sense that space in Israel is. In fact, when one builds a synagogue, it is customary to stand up and publicly declare this is not a holy space. It is only a building, a yard, a room, or whatever it is, and should the need come about after a period of years to sell this space, there is no desanctification issue. This was never made sacred. You can sell the space, you know, for some legitimate purpose, not to be a tannery or a bathhouse, but that, you know, there are fairly few brothel, you know, limits on what the building could be sold for. Otherwise, it's a courtyard. You can sell and do whatever you want. All right? But this is in terms of space. This text, which I had over there, I don't know if you all picked it up or not. It came out a little bit later. This is a passage from the Mishnah. Mishnah was written around the year 200. It is the earliest rabbinic text that we have. This is not part of the Bible. Those of you who have ever read part of the Bible will recognize that the style is very different. But I chose this as a sample of an example of how the rabbis deal with this question. All right, so the Mishnah says, if the townspeople sell the town square, they may buy with the proceeds a synagogue. If they sell a synagogue, they may buy with the proceeds an ark. An ark is the holy ark, you know, that put the Torah in it. If they sell an ark, they may buy wrappings for scrolls. If they sell the wrappings, they may buy scrolls. Scrolls don't necessarily mean Torah scrolls. They're of other biblical books, as you'll see in a second. If they sell scrolls, they may buy a Sefer Torah. That's a Torah scroll, which is a higher sanctity than regular scrolls, or scrolls of other biblical books. But if they sell a Torah scroll, they may not buy, with the proceeds, other scrolls. If they sell scrolls, they may not buy wrappings. If they sell wrappings, they may not buy an ark. If they sell an ark, they may not buy a synagogue. If they sell a synagogue, they may not buy a town square. And the same applies to the money left over. So what you see here is, in effect, a hierarchy of sanctity that doesn't focus specifically on space. I would say this is about the sanctity of objects, but some of those objects are spaces. And so what you clearly have a listing here, according to priority, and for clarity's purposes, it goes both ways, up and down. But the bottom line is that while this is about sanctity, it is not about holy space, in the same sense as we talk about the temple in Jerusalem or whatever. Right? Now, I could spend a great deal of time dealing with the issue of holy space, Jerusalem temple, purity laws associated with the temple and everything else. These are essentially non-functional, have been for 2,000 years. And so I would rather spend a couple of minutes talking about one other issue that I think is more interesting in the contemporary world. And that is what, according to contemporary Judaism, should be going on the top of that mountain in Jerusalem. When you go to visit, one of the things that's very prominent is a big sign that says, don't let go up there. The rabbinate has put up a sign that says, Jews are not allowed to go up into the Temple Mount.
Jews are not allowed
to go up to the Temple Mount.
Non-Jews. Non-Jews can go up.
It doesn't say anything about non-Jews.
Well, now only Muslims over the age of 40.
Wow. So they won't create trouble.
The Muslims only allow Muslims now, and the Israeli government only the age of 40 will create trouble. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, but that aside, okay, what is supposed to happen on this place, right? So there's this major issue as to whether there is an obligation to reestablish the temple in antiquity. Tear down the mosque, as it were, which some people say, or as others have it, because of some ancient tradition, that the third temple will actually descend from heaven magically. And so everyone's standing around waiting for the temple. They're not going to do anything until that happens. I figure that's a good procedure. Peace will stay a lot longer if they wait for the temple to come down from the skies. But be that as it may, there is a question, and there are people in Jerusalem who are training to be active priests, learning how to slaughter the sacrifices and go through all the rituals and so forth, and to recreate all the purity situations. So the whole thing is there, as it were, in waiting, but it isn't there in reality. What's in reality is this ban that says Jews are not allowed to go up to the Temple Mount. Now, if you look at the literature, the legal literature that actually describes this, what you're not allowed to do is go where the temple was. You're allowed to go up the temple. Okay, so what we have here now is a politically expedient decree by the rabbinate that has essentially put this place off limits to Jews. And this is long before the Intifada. This is not a response to this tension, really. Said, stay away from there. And the question then becomes, so what is the nature of this holy area? In theory, this is the holiest area in Judaism. What the rabbinate in Israel has done is to say, well, the Muslims can go there because they go there, but Jews can't go there because we've said you shouldn't, when my comment is the halachic literature actually says you're allowed to go there, you just can't go in the middle where the mosque is. Presumably it's on top of where the temple was, but even that's not certain. But you could, for example, walk around the perimeter without really much chance of being in the area where the temple was, and this should be permitted. In fact, somebody wrote an article in a Festra some years ago charting the history of all the reports of Jewish travelers over the centuries who actually went up there. So, this used to be a fairly accepted procedure, and this has changed. This is another example of where I have serious questions about the authority and intelligence of the Israeli chief rabbinate. Because what they have done, this has been the case now for, I don't know, more than 25 years. The bottom line is they have no idea what to do with this space. And in fact, they're probably happier letting the Muslims have it because they can blame them for whatever happens, and they don't know what to do with it, right? They can't activate it in any positive way for Jewish purposes. Now, when we met in another session a couple years ago in Israel with Sha'ar Yashuv Kohen, you were there, right? He was talking about creating some kind of joint, prayer house up there where everybody could go and pray. Now, for the chief rabbi of Haifa to talk like that is quite unusual, but no one's listening, except maybe Allah, right? Nobody's hearing this, right? So, well, I wouldn't say it's impossible that it will happen. I don't hear anybody writing about it in the paper these days. See anybody writing about it here? You know, this is an idea whose time just hasn't come yet. But here we have the holiest space in the world, according to Judaism, and it is essentially defunct, which I think is a serious problem. And it, you know, if it ever reaches the point where the rabbinate endorses abandoning the space forever, I will never again have any use for the Israeli rabbinate, because it just makes no sense. And I don't know what to tell them to do with it, but just to say, you know, give it away because we can't use it anymore, and it does more violence to the system than half of the other criticisms that have been leveled at it.
Can I give a personal, spiritual take on that? I mean, just the way you described it is certainly correct. But as a fairly observant Jew, when I'm there around the Temple Mount, I don't go up the Temple Mount, you know, superficially for the reason that you said, but spiritually from a very different reason. And that is that the only relic of the ancient temple is the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall. So when I stand at the Western Wailing Wall, I know this is part of the temple, and I feel as if I'm praying, this is the closest I can get to God, to the Shekhinah. If I actually walk up the steps by the side, and I'm suddenly on a completely different plane, I'm actually in the middle of some sort of archaeological area, and then I enter into a mosque, for me, when I go down and then pray back at the Wailing Wall, that has totally negated the spiritual meaning of my personal prayer. So I don't go up there because of what it will do to me, not because of any particular rabbinical ban, because it just doesn't make any sense to what I do the rest of my time.
I didn't follow the logic. It was spiritually significant when you would go to the Wailing Wall, but then if you walk up above, you know, the archaeological site, you're saying that kind of negates the meaning of...
Yeah, look, put it differently. If I'm a Christian and I'm in a church, okay, and then I go outside the church and I see sitting on top of the church happens to be a shopping mall, you know, then the church means something very different if there's just a spire and there's the heavens above it. So suddenly I'm standing at the Wailing Wall and I'm praying and I don't know what's above it. Our concern, this is the holiest place there is.
So you,
but suddenly, knowing that there's a mosque up there and there's other things up there, for me, you know, is challenging, is diluting my own personal spiritual experience.
Whereas in the morning, I was talking about Buddhas functioning in a variety of different dimensions at the same time as part of really their practice. They're supposed to be doing that.
Yeah.
You're saying that that's...
But that's a very personal take. I mean, I don't know about anybody else, you know,
thinks
that way.
You see it as an end initially, but then if you can go on top of it, it becomes a means to
end. Why are you
lying
under the strip?
Why are you
lying under the strip? Why are you lying under the strip?
If I can interject something practical from the Muslim side as well. First of all, I mean, you know, for those who haven't been up there, it's a really big space. I mean, the top of that mountain is big. There's a lot of space, and there's plenty of room, you know, to do what the rabbi of Haifa was suggesting. So, I mean, that's there's a practicality there. But there are two complicating issues. Now, I'm speaking prescriptively here because there has been a very, very differing Muslim discourse about, you know, the nature of the... Well, there's two things. There's Masjid al-Aqsa and there's the Dome of the Rock. And there's differing discourses about all of this, and the latest craziness from the Palestinians is that there was never anything up there anyway. It's all Muslim space, so anyway, that's just stupid. But apart from that, there have been a lot of other discussions that are less stupid. When I've seen archaeological estimations of where the temple was, it's pretty clear that the Masjid al-Aqsa is on part of that space. Mm-hmm. All right. Apparently, it's not exactly coterminous with the Masjid al-Aqsa. And in terms of my own spirituality, my feeling that I described when I was there, feeling this kind of the rootedness, almost like an axis going through my body, to me is an expression of that, the reality of that space and the fact that a temple was there. I as a Muslim aware of history, I feel both. All right, so I'm very, very sensitive to apart from the ritual obligation of the temple, the spiritual feeling as well. But from a practical point of view, even if there were a way to build a temple that didn't take away the Muslim mosque, on the Muslim point of view, the big problem would be the sacrifice, because blood is defiling, and you don't have blood in a sacred space. That's the real practical issue, you know, from the point of view of how traditionally the religion is done. When it comes to sharing space, that's not a problem. You know, the Tomb of the Patriarchs has been shared for centuries until recent times.
I was going to say not well. Yeah. Okay.
Well, not well, but I mean, but the fact the precedent's there. I mean, listen, people are people, but I mean, the precedent is there, and so one could always resurrect that precedent if the two sides found a way to live with each other and share the space. The practical issue would be the sacrifice.
Yeah, but I don't think we're anywhere near the point where we can talk about putting a sacrificial system back to work.
Right.
These guys in Israel are doing it, but I didn't intend to indicate that that's going to happen tomorrow. I think it would be a much bigger step forward to create a shared prayer space.
I agree. Right.
And then, of course, the funny part about the whole conversation was, after this all happened in the conference in Israel, the papal emissary decided that the Christians should really have a share in this prayer space up there too. We finally got the Jews and the Muslims to agree that they could talk about this, and they decided they had to be players in it as well. But I suppose if that was the original Solomonic dream, that the temple would be a house of prayer for all peoples, then that ought to be possible up there. I mean, you know, you just need people to be of goodwill and willing to cooperate. Anyway, let me move on. We're not going to solve this one. Before reference was made to changing sizes and aesthetics and this kind of stuff in churches, and I think it's important to point out that there's a similar dynamic going on in Judaism, particularly in the West. I happen to live in a community that is something like 95 or 98% Jewish in Canada, all right? It was claimed when I moved there that it was, in fact, the highest concentration of Jews in any city in the world, including Israel. Now, maybe it's excluding Israel, but whatever it is, almost everybody in this town is Jewish. Côte Saint-Luke, would you believe, is the name.
Côte
Saint-Luke. Okay. In any case, if you look in the area around where I've lived now in the same place for 12 years, and I moved once, a few blocks away, so if you count that, it's 25 years. In the last 10 to 12 years, at least a dozen places for me to pray on Saturday morning have opened up that weren't there originally. One of them is in a former department store in a mall. The store went out of business. Lubavitch took over the store. They built a synagogue. A couple of small storefront kind of places were turned into active synagogues. Large synagogues opened up a second and third service. Okay, there are some in private homes. Why do I say this? Because within the Orthodox Jewish community, there seems to be a move away from large, formal places of worship into small personal ones where you get more personal involvement in the service, more opportunities for you to participate in as an individual if there are only 40 people there or 20 people there than if there are 400 people there. I don't believe this phenomenon took place in a left-wing Jewish group called the Chabura movement some years back, but it's not nearly as prominent because there aren't that many Jews who affiliate with that branch of Judaism. But what you see here is what a lot of rabbis in big synagogues have come to criticize very strongly, because the sense is that these are educated Jews who are living a religious life outside the formal structures, and yet they aren't. Technically, they're following all the rules, perhaps even better than they would have been if they were active participants in the large synagogues. And so there's this tension that exists in many places now about the styles of synagogues and the sizes of synagogues. And there's one synagogue in Montreal which talks about itself as the Cathedral Synagogue. It is a huge place, right, which is most...
Orthodox?
Yeah, well, it has a mechitza, always been Orthodox, and it's Shar Shamayim, right?
Oh.
Okay, but they call themselves the Cathedral, okay? They have always had separate seating for men and women. The membership tends to be unobservant Orthodox, whereas the clergy are Orthodox. And these people are constantly going through this crisis of what to do with this gigantic building that they have. Often they run the services in a small chapel or whatever because they just can't fill it up other than a couple days a year.
And this